You are listening to Pardes from Jerusalem, the weekly Parsha podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit www.elmad.pardes.org. This week, Rabbi Alex Israel discusses Parashat Shoftim. Before we hear from Alex, just to let you know, the registration is now open for the Pardes Heritage Poland trip, happening from January 15th to the 19th, 2017. Join us for a deep, meaningful, and spiritually uplifting journey alongside our year program students that will explore the 900-year history of what was the largest Jewish community in the world. For more information, visit www.pardes.org.il/Poland.
This week's Parsha is Parashat Shoftim, and I find it particularly fascinating in that it really deals with the very pressing and difficult and thorny questions of national administration and of running a Jewish state according to ethical standards and values in a very, very difficult environment. And if we're going to dive right in to the Parsha, we're going to look at the latter half of the Parsha, chapter 19, 20, and 21. Which all deal with questions of taking life and of war. Any nation has to sometimes involve itself at war. Otherwise, we would have no option of self-defense. And there are also occasions in which we have to engage in acts of aggression. We have to wage war, not just merely to protect ourselves, but to further national interests. This has been the way of every nation from the history of time, or else we would cease to exist. And the Jewish nation is no different. However, one of the amazing accolades of the Torah is that the Torah has a whole set of laws which deal with this. We're all familiar, probably, with the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot, and the command, Lo Tirtzach, thou shalt not murder. Mistakenly translated, by the way, by the King James Bible, thou shalt not kill. There is no prohibition of killing, there's a prohibition of murdering, as we shall see in a minute. But if we take a look through this parasha, we will see an amazing pattern developing. And I'd like to maybe begin by skimming the big picture and then going into a few details. I'm going to open at chapter 20. And it tells us the following, Ki teitzela milchama al oivecha, when you go out to war against your enemy. And this particular passage deals with the question of mobilization of forces, the draft. Who should be in the Jewish army? Who should be mobilized? And who should be given exemptions? And here we see an almost surprising exemption. V'dibru ha'shotrim al ha'am, the officers speak to the people when they're mobilizing, and they say, Mi ha'ish asher bana bayit chadash v'lo chanacho? Is there anyone who just built a new house, but hasn't lived in it? In that case, yelecha yashuv leveito. You can go home to your house. Pen yamut b'milchama v'ish acher yechanachenu. Lest he dies in war, and some other man will dedicate his house. Mi ha'ish asher nata kerem v'lo chilolo? Is there anyone who's planted a vineyard and hasn't yet drank the wine? He also, Yelech v'yashuv leveito, pen yamut b'mulchama, v'ish acher yichalelenu. He should also go home because maybe if he dies in war, somebody else will drink his wine. And is there anybody, Yashay Rasi Shava lo lakacha, who is engaged to, betrothed to a woman but has not yet married her? And he should also go home because the greatest tragedy would be if somebody else would marry her, lest he die in war. Fascinating image of an army getting mobilized, and suddenly they say, well, is there anybody who's just at the beginning of their life, who has just dedicated planted a new vineyard, built a new house, got engaged? Okay, you are exempt from the battlefield. What is all this about? What is the concern here? here there's a fascinating argument where the Ibn Ezra says, V'hatam, the reason why these people are sent home is kilibo v'chol tavato l'chinuch beito, the person who's just built a new house. All he can think about is his new home. That's what his mind is on. He can't focus on the war. Hinei libo l'beito v'lo l'milchama. His mind is on his home and not on war. Al kin yanus v'yanis achirim. So what he's going to become a misery in war. He won't have the courage and the focus in order to fight. The person who's just engaged and is waiting to marry his beloved is going to be pining for her, and he's not going to want to put himself in the line of fire and to really encounter the enemy because his mind is really on something else. And therefore, Ibn Ezra understands that this exemption is tactical in nature. Fully understandable. By the way, in the next line, it even tells us, and the officers continue to say, Mi ha'ish hayarei varach ha'levav. Who is fearful and who is weak of heart, he should also go home. In other words, we need to have an army who is lean and mean and ardent, and we want people who can fight without cowering and without being too afraid. And especially if you have an army of reserves who aren't necessarily fully trained, we're very worried and we're very concerned that the people we have in the battlefield not somehow chicken out in the middle. And this seems to be the major concern of these groups. The group who has just built a house, the group who's just planted a vineyard, who are just engaged, and even those who are simply fearful. This is the Ibn Ezra's approach. However, there's always different perspectives. And the famous commentator Rashi says something very different. And he focuses on the phrase here in verse 5, in verse 6, where it says, let the person who's built a house go home, lest he dies in war, and somebody else will dedicate his house. The person who's made the vineyard, lest he dies in war, and somebody else will dedicate his vineyard. The person who's just engaged, lest he die in war, and another man marry his beloved. And Rashi says, V'davar zeh shel ogmat nefeshu. This is something which will be a source of anguish, a source of distress. This is expanded by the famous commentator Rav David Zvi Hoffman, who says, our sacred Torah, which attaches as much importance to the individual's private life as it does to the expansion of the nation's borders, commands all those mentioned in this passage to return to their homes. According to Rashi and Rav David Zvi Hoffman, what is really going on here? What seems to be happening is that along with the need to engage in battle, there is also a need to look after the home front. In other words, of course a nation would like to have the largest army possible when they're encountering their enemy in the battlefield. But if we divert all resources into war, what will be left on the day after war? What will happen to society? And here it seems that the Torah says that indeed the nation is in armed conflict, and yet life has to go on. If somebody's engaged, if somebody's in the process of building a home, just beginning their field, we should let those processes run their course. We want to have young families. We want the investment which has been put into this field, into this vineyard, to actually produce fruit. We don't want the house to remain empty. And maybe if the person does go to war, and even if he comes back safe and sound from the battlefield, he will simply have been so taken off the project that he will never finish it. And the Torah is almost saying that yes, a nation sometimes have to fight, but there is also a counterbalance. There are fields to be planted, there are houses to be built, there are families to, there are couples to be married and to establish families. Even when we go to war, we need to make sure that war isn't all we do. That we keep on building, we build a healthy society, because there will always be a day after all. This is an amazing statement for the Torah to give to us, because I don't know if there's a, I haven't scanned parallel societies and their writings about war, but there's no sense of bravado here, there's no sense of, you know, we're going to thrash the enemy. There's a very realistic look. You're going to need to fight, and yet make sure that there are other priorities which counterbalance. And here I would like to show you the pattern that continues, and we'll focus on a few other things. The very next paragraph, the war's begun, and you've already advanced against the enemy, and now you are coming against your enemy city. The first phrase, v'karata aleha l'shalom. You should call for peace against the other city. If they open in peace, then, in other words, they accept your terms, then they serve you. In other words, you become the national government and they have to pay you taxes, as would happen in a classic vassal arrangement in the ancient world. If they decide to fight, there are all sorts of conditions. Here, indeed, there is also a very famous machloket argument between Rashi and the Ramban, on Rashi on the one side and Nachmanides and Maimonides on the other side. And I'm going to follow the views of Maimonides and Nachmanides, who say that there was always a call for peace in any war that the Israelites embarked on. In fact, as the Israelites went to capture the land of Canaan, they sent letters ahead of them and said, whoever would like to leave the country you are entering, you can leave. Whoever wants to make peace can make peace. But if you want to make war, all right, we're ready for war too. Once again, the opportunity for people to leave the battlefield, and if they're non-combatants, to simply move out of the line of fire. The opportunity for the enemy to actually agree to the terms of the attacking force, and therefore not to be embroiled in armed conflict, is there. And the opportunity for war is there. Once again, the Torah is thinking. Think about, even from a literary perspective, Ki tikrav el ir lehilachem aleha, when you come against a city to fight against it, or would say maybe even more, to attack it. V'karata aleha l'shalom. The first thing you need to do is ask for peace. In other words, already within our ethic of war, don't worry, in later verses it says, and if they fight against you, you should kill all the menfolk, even certain situations where you should kill the women and children. Now's not the time where I want to get involved in that discussion, but the rules of engagement, as they are given by the Torah, is when you go to attack another city, the first thing you should do is call out l'shalom, that powerful word, in peace. The next one tells us what happens when the war's advanced even more. Ki tatsur al ir yamim rabim lilachem aleha. When you have now besieged the city that obviously you want to attack, for yamim rabim, for many days, maybe even should be translated as many years. We know that certain cities, like Shomron, like Yerushalayim, were besieged for 2, even 3 years. So the siege is protracted. Notice the progression through the war. Our first one was, our first parasha, our first paragraph, Ki tetzel milchama alovecha, when you go out for war against your enemies, you're mobilizing who goes to war and who is exempted. Second one, you're already fighting and you're approaching the enemy. And now you've approached the enemy, they did not put up the white flag, and what you do is you besiege them, and the siege is going on for many days. I imagine then the soldiers are interested in ending the siege as soon as possible. However, the Torah warns us, even though you are parked outside this city, even though you are besieging it, Lo tashchit et Yisrael in doach alav garzen ki mimena tochel v'oto lo tifros. Lo tashchit, you shall not destroy, you shall not cut down the fruit trees of the enemy. Because, as it says here, you may eat of them, but you must not cut them down. Only trees that you do not yield fruit may be destroyed. This is an amazing instruction, which is called Bal Tashchit, do not destroy. And it warns against wanton destruction, even in the middle of a battle. Again, what is the rationale here? So first of all, it might well be that an army would like to engage in a scorched earth policy. After all, there might be a huge amount of frustration on the part of the troops. And in fact, it might even be a way to bring the city down when everybody sees their villages and fields and vineyards and orchards being burnt to the ground. It will weaken morale as the enemy are holed up in the city and put pressure on them, indeed, to give up the fight. It might even be a sign of rage on the part of the soldiers stuck there for months and years just simply to take it out on the countryside. There might even be a practical reason for cutting down trees in order to build siege engines and in order to build maybe temporary homes for the winter for the attacking soldiers. And in this situation, once again, the Torah tells us, do not cut down fruit trees. And it has the amazing phrase, Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh. One reading is, are trees of the field human to withdraw before you to the besieged city? In other words, what do you have against the trees? People can run away. Trees can't run away. But what we see here seems to be, once again, a concern that even though the bullets fly and the flames of conflict are all around, don't engage in a scorched earth policy, because there will be a day after the war where people need to go back to their fields. And if there are no fruit trees, what are they going to live off? From what are they going to subsist? The country has to be remained livable even in the day after the war. The last in this series is actually at the beginning of next week's parsha, where the war's finished, and then we say, Ki teitzeina milchama eloivecha, when you go to war, unetano Hashem elokecha biyadecha, and you win, v'shavitav shivyo, and you take prisoners of war. Now, what does a person do? If a man sees amongst the captives, a soldier sees amongst the captives, a pretty woman, a beautiful woman, and he wants to take her as his wife, what can he do? And this particular parsha warns us that he has to, there's a whole bunch of conditions, but he has to take her as her wife, and he is not allowed to sell her, he is not allowed to force her or rape her, he has to take her and make him his wife, or else he has to give her her freedom. Again, there's much to talk about this particular parsha of Ki Teitze, but the Torah essentially is trying to, again, in the thorny and messy an ethically problematic situation of the war field, maybe the big worry is that people will take women, young women, from the war, from the prisoners of war, they'll take them home as trophy wives and what have you. And the Torah has very strict rules about how women of the prisoners of war, whose husbands were probably killed in the battlefield, should be treated. And they can only, the only condition in which they can be taken is if they'd be given full rights as a Jewish wife. Otherwise, they have to be not traded. They're not allowed to be traded as slaves. They're not allowed to be used and abused and discarded. And there's much to discuss here. But what I see here is the Torah grappling with the difficult situation of war in a succession of different parashiyot, of different rules, which then come together as an entire ethic of war. Now here I'd like to draw the lens even further and realize that the Torah isn't only talking about the war, the battlefield, but even about something more than that. Because immediately before this whole series about war, we have the story about the Ir Miklat, the refuge cities, that if somebody kills by accident, he has a place to flee. And here the emphasis is that a person should get a fair trial. That we shouldn't have a situation where somebody accidentally murders somebody. Where there's a case where, chas v'shalom, God forbid, there is a car accident and somebody is killed in a moment of negligence, and then that person should be put to death. Somebody should take out their vengeance on this person. There has to be a trial which assesses if the murder was in the first degree, in cold blood, whether it was an accident, whether it was a mistake, what degree of culpability there is. There's a deep concern on the part of the Torah that blood not be spilt in vain, that spilt blood have some sort of comeuppance, and yet at the same time, that there not be a wild environment where life is taken outside the court of law. There are refuge cities, the person is put on trial. If they're guilty of murder, they will be put to death. But on the other hand, if it was accidental or if they're not guilty, they will be either incarcerated or they will be freed. So there is a due process of law. But it's not only here. If you look at chapter 21, you will see another incredible passage where it talks about if you find a situation in which you encounter a homicide, you encounter a body lying somewhere in the countryside with signs of violence. Somebody has been murdered. Who murdered them? We don't know. You bring in the forensics, who knows? But the Torah isn't talking about forensics. The Torah says you measure to the closest town. And the elders of the town have to come out and they need to engage in a rite of expiation. In fact, what they do is they take a heifer, a young heifer, and they break the neck of the heifer, and then they utter a prayer where the priests come forward and they say, our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it. Absolve, O Lord, your people Israel, who you've redeemed, and do not let guilt for the blood of the innocent remain among your people Israel. The rabbis say, what could the elders of the town have done? Are the elders of the town guilty? Why do they say, we did not kill this person? And the rabbis say, well, first of all, by the way, what would be your answer? You might say, well, there should be more law and order in the area. There should be more police. There should be more safety. You should apprehend criminals more. The rabbis say they are guilty because they should have accompanied this individual. Again, their assumption is this person is traveling alone between the towns, and that a murderer saw him alone and killed him. And that if the elders of the town would have accompanied him, if they would have made sure that the roads were safer, then this person would not have been killed. One could apply it in a modern context to that law authorities should be, I don't know, more ardent in enforcing traffic rules to make sure that the roads are safe, to make sure that traffic laws are enforced, and that people aren't driving wild on the roads, and also to make sure that the streets are safe at night. Whichever way, here's the point. We've just been talking about war. And in the middle of all this, when you go out to war against your enemies, when you're besieging for many days, prisoners of war, in the middle of this, we talk about a homicide on the home front. And I ask myself, why does the Torah stick this story about a homicide on the home front right in the middle of all these different passages which deal with the battlefield? And I think the answer is obvious. The concern is that when the country of Israel is engaged in war, that there will be a cheapening of life. There will be a sense that life loses its value. So many lives are being lost in a war campaign. Okay, another murder. Asma, so what? And the Torah says that cannot be. The civilian elders of the town, even while the war is going on, have to be extra specially careful to value and cherish life. And even if one life is taken of some traveller who is an anonymous traveller, we don't even know who they are, you have to engage in a special rite and say, Yadeinu lo shafchu et adam hazeh ve'einenu lo ra'u. We didn't do this, we're not responsible, we did everything in our power to make sure that our streets and our byways were safe. And we ask God to atone for the innocent blood of this person. We read the statistics about lives lost on the road. We read the statistics about the number of homicides in our cities. And we're also only too aware of war which rages in Syria, in different places in the world. We, here in the State of Israel, also have to deal with the very realistic situation of armed conflict. We haven't yet reached a stage where we can say that we've reached the Menucha v'Nachala, a state of rest or a state of peace, yet. And I find it incredible that sometimes in the Torah you see a law here or a command there or a prohibition. And there are two ways to look at that prohibition. Sometimes you can look at it as an isolated mitzvah. Sometimes there, you know, take a mitzvah like a mezuzah. So you could say there's a law of a mezuzah when you buy a house, when you have a house, when you have a Jewish house. You put a mezuzah on the door. You put a mezuzah on the doorways of the house. But in truth, the mezuzah is just one amongst many symbols which, first of all, mark us as Jews, and are also signs of remembrance of deeper ideas. One could even include in this the whole idea of tzitzit, which the fringes on our garments, the tefillin on our heads, even the notion of Brit Milah and other things which mark out a Jew. Sometimes it isn't just an isolated command, but there's an entire sort of ethic which go around it. There are ethics in many areas of Judaism. There are ethics of welfare and employment. And when you look at welfare, there's a law of tzedakah, of charity, but there's also a law to pay your workers on time. There's also a law to leave a corner of the field for the poor. There are laws of Shemitah where every 7 years the field should remain ownerless and it should act as an equalizer between the rich and the poor. In other words, there isn't just one law about poverty. There are many which deal with social justice and balancing the economy in order to create welfare and social security. And that is exactly, I think, what is happening in our Parshat HaShavua. We have an entire series which goes through the process of engaging in war, engaging in conflict. Starts off with the mobilization of the battlefields and says that some people should simply not be in the war because there has to be a balance between the home front and the army. Likewise, even within war, one can't just simply attack brutally. One has to call for peace. One has to even care for the trees. One has to care for the prisoners of war and not allow the prisoners of war to be taken advantage of. And even on the home front, one has to be in the middle of this extra special carefully about homicides, of accidental murders, of making sure that everybody gets a fair trial, that murderers are apprehended, but people who kill accidentally are also go through the due process of law. And therefore, when I look at this parasha, I see a very sophisticated legal system which tries to be very, very honest about the needs of a country to engage in armed conflict, but is very much trying to minimize the civilian cost of all of that and trying to balance some of the human values in the midst of the human carnage that takes place in war. So I hope, as you look at the parasha, whether you listen to it in shul or whether you have a chance to maybe pick up a chumash, pick up a Bible this weekend and take a look through, you will see these delicate balances which are taking place and this very sophisticated mosaic which is created by all the different laws which make up Parashat Shoftim in order to try and create that balance between a nation which has to engage in acts of violence in order to defend itself or in order to further its own interests, and at the same time the potential damage that can be done in loss of life and the damage that can be done to the civilian home front. May we always be given the blessing of peace and not of war, and hope that that indeed we as a Jewish people and society at large learn the Karata Alecha L'Shalom, that we should always, before we even think about any violence, always make sure that we've exhausted every opportunity of peace before we go down that road. I wish you all Shabbat Shalom, And since it is Elul, I will also wish you all a ketivah v'chatima tova, to be written and sealed for a good, sweet, and wonderful year ahead. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you for listening to Pardes from Jerusalem, the weekly Parsha podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit www.elmad.pardes.org.